Okay, we're back on the record. Mr. Morrison, you can call your next witness.
Thank you. Our final witness will be Bill McCarthy.
And Mr. McCarthy, I need to give you the oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Bill, would you state your name for the record and tell us by whom you're employed and in what capacity?
William McCarthy. I'm employed by E3 Environmental, and I'm an environmental project manager.
And can you give us your business address?
871 Jefferson Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And you have testified for the commission on a number of times as an expert on applications for siting, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you were responsible for preparation of the application and the amended application, is correct?
Yes, sir.
Can you describe the process that you went through to come up with the initial study corridor and the corridor in which field studies were done?
Yes, sir. We work with the client, and in this case, we had at least an initial endpoint with the plant being the source of product, and they had existing assets that they wanted to tie into. So that narrowed the potential routes that we would explore. The rest of the process is a bit of an iterative process involving right-of-way engineering and environmental concerns to develop a route that's palatable to the majority of those disciplines. Once the route has been narrowed, we begin our environmental studies, which starts with desktop studies of published information, usually GIS-based, working with National Wetland Inventory and resources such as that. To identify any type of natural resources that might be of concern from a routing perspective. We also then engage agencies with responsibilities of some of these resources, such as Fish and Wildlife Service, North Dakota Game and Fish, Parks and Rec, as well as the School Trust and Mineral Trust here in Minnesota.
North Dakota?
Yes, North Dakota, apologize. And then as we refine our route and our studies, we go to field studies. The field studies is a pedestrian survey of the actual route. In this case, we typically use a 250-foot survey corridor. We, in preparation of our cultural resource studies, we would do what's called a Class 1 inventory. We go to the SHPO office and review the records of what types of resources may have been previously recorded within our study corridor and our survey. And then we go do our Class 3 pedestrian surveys for cultural resources. And then we would also employ ecologists to do the natural resource surveys, which would study the wetland water bodies, take a tree and shrub inventory, and do habitat analysis for threatened and endangered species.
And your initial desktop study was on a one-mile corridor centered on the anticipated route, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you're familiar with the amended route, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And it's my understanding that the original route, over 90% of that route was co-located with existing facilities, is that correct?
That's correct.
And with the amendment, will there still be co-location with other transmission or gathering facilities?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And is that because the 16-inch gathering line that the prior witnesses talked about will go in the amended route area so that you'll have co-location over 100% of the route, essentially?
Essentially, that's correct, or thereabouts.
You talked about your consultations with the Fish and Wildlife Service, Game and Fish Department, Parks and Rec, Department of Trust Lands, and SHPO. Did any of those federal and state agencies have any concerns or objections with respect to the line, other than their kind of standard comments that they submit on all projects?
There were no objections or concerns other than kind of their normal areas of interest, so no.
And the cultural studies, were there any cultural resources that will be impacted within the by the proposed route?
The route will not impact any cultural resources.
And SHPO has concurred with that, both with respect to the original route and the amended route. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And we filed those SHPO concurrences with the commission. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep.
Are there any other exclusion areas or avoidance areas that will be impacted by the route?
There is an occupied structure.
And that is shown on the Appendix B, Map 2. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's on the unaffected portion of the route, so they can look at either Exhibit 1 or Exhibit 2, and then it'll be the same.
That is correct.
And you did obtain, or One Oak did obtain, a waiver from the owner of that residence?
A waiver has been received, and it was filed with the original application under Appendix G.
If you look at particularly page 2 of 2 of Appendix B, it does show that there are some wetlands and some woody vegetation areas that will be impacted, or they'll be crossed by the pipeline. Are there any particular concerns raised by those in considering how the pipeline will be constructed?
No, sir. It's impossible, really, to build a pipeline of any length up in this kind of landscape without encountering some type of a feature, wetland, or water body. And pipeline operators and construction are very familiar with working around these types of resources. The regulatory authorities that have the jurisdictional oversight of such activities, primarily being the Army Corps of Engineers, is well aware, as also, and offers permits, which can be self-guided, self-certification, particularly Nationwide 12, which is for utility lines specific to pipelines. And an operator such as One Oak can do the environmental studies, much like we have conducted for the PSC here, understand what the resources are at each of the individual crossings, and provided there are no cultural resource or threatened endanger type natural resource issues, and that they execute the crossing in a manner that's consistent with the conditions of the permit, which are fairly standard best management practices. These crossings can be conducted in a way that's environmentally sensitive, minimizes those impacts, and fully compliant.
And to your knowledge, have either all the permits that are necessary for the construction and operation of the project either now been obtained, or will they be obtained before that particular practice is undertaken?
Yes, they've all been scheduled and would be in hand prior to engaging in the regulated activity. Yes, sir.
Bill, in your opinion, will the location operation of this pipeline produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
That's correct.
And is the pipeline compatible with the environmental preservation, the efficient use of resources?
Yes, sir.
And will the pipeline minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in orderly and timely fashion?
Yes, sir.
I don't have further questions. The witness at this time.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor. The original application disclosed that there was one inhabited rural residence within 500 feet of the pipeline. Did that number change at all with the amended route?
No, sir.
Okay. Can I have you turn to Appendix C of the original application? And also Appendix C of the amended one as well? Just let me know when you have, when you're there.
Yes, sir.
The first letter that is included in Appendix C is one from One Oak Partners to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and is dated November 20, 2014. Do you see that letter?
Yes, sir.
Has One Oak ever received a response from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to this letter?
We've not received a response from the Fish and Wildlife Service to this project notification. We have followed up, and most recently this week, to give them an opportunity to comment, and the agency has not chosen not to respond.
Do you have any idea when you may get a response from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service?
I think it's likely that they will choose not to respond. It's not uncommon, from my experience, with these types of applications and these types of agency notifications, particularly with this agency. When they get engaged, they typically ask the first question if there's some other federal nexus that would obligate them to respond. I think it's a workload issue, and I think They perhaps review the materials and find the project to be benign and not of concern and have chosen not to respond.
Then in Appendix C of the amended application, the only agency it looks like that there was a change with was SHPO. Have the other agencies that you contacted been notified of this amended route?
We did not re-engage the agency notifications because the route deviation was fully within the one-mile corridor and was such a minor magnitude off the original alignment that we felt that the original consultations more than adequately covered this minor change.
And have you run into the situation before and handled it the same way?
When the magnitude of change was similar to this, I've handled it the same way. Contrarily, when route modifications were significant and were excessive, we have re-engaged the agencies.
So in this situation, why did you only contact SHPO as opposed to any of the other organizations?
Because two parts to that answer. One, we feel obligated to the PSC to demonstrate that the SHPO concurrence of no effect. That's a primary obligation for this audience. Secondarily, when you conduct surveys, Class 3 inventories, there's an obligation by the permit holder, the principal investigator, to engage the SHPO with those results. So as part of that consultation, we want to make it part of the record.
As long as we're on the SHPO issue, you said in your direct testimony that there were going to be no cultural resources located along this route. Is that correct?
Won't be impacted by the route, correct.
Does One Oak have a plan in place in the event of an unexpected find? And if so, what is it?
Yes, sir. There is a unanticipated find or unanticipated discovery plan that's in place. And we do train the contractors on a project-specific basis to it. The thumbnail approach is that we train the individuals engaged primarily in ground disturbing activities, but all personnel that in the event that a potential cultural resource is uncovered, that they establish a minimum of a 100-foot exclusion zone, stop work in that area, and then begin the notification process within the organization so we can bring in a qualified archaeologist to further evaluate and then begin the external communication with agencies as necessary.
I want to switch gears here. Can I have you turn to page 6 of the initial route permit and page 5 of the route permit amendment? I just want to clarify something on these. Let me know when you have a chance to get there.
Okay.
On page 6 of the initial route permit, it states that there were three potentially jurisdictional wetland features within a 100-foot-wide construction right-of-way. In the amended route permit on page 5, it states that the field surveys indicate four additional potentially jurisdictional wetland features within the 100-foot-wide construction right-of-way. So does this mean that now there are 7 jurisdictional wetlands, or are there just 4?
I see you're saying there are 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you're talking about the methods that One Oak will use to minimize impact, the term best management practices came up in the application. I know you alluded to it here. I've heard it in a variety of other hearings as well. Can you just kind of explain what you mean by best management practices?
You bet. And thank you for the opportunity to clarify. Best management practices really there are some industry standards and there's agency requirements as well, and they're all very similar. And the intent is to minimize the impacts of construction so that your restoration has the best opportunity to be successful. And so it really revolves around minimizing your footprint where you can, you know, the amount of disturbance that's fundamental to all these plans. Very often it also circulates around topsoil management because you want to preserve that, segregate that, and ensure then that it's returned to the upper soil horizon. So again, for your restoration purposes. Some of the other best management practices involve minimizing the amount of time that soils are exposed and disturbed. There are certain best management practices with stream crossings where there might be timelines associated with that, and then restoration practices specific to stream banks. There are some best management practices associated with when you're working in topographic areas with some gradients that you may install trench breakers to prevent water from being like a conduit down your pipeline, break that up a little bit. Then also as you restore, to put slope breakers in on the surface to help that water cascading down to be spilled off in a controlled manner to reduce the erosional force of that sheet flow. So there's several steps along the way. It starts with the planning, minimize your footprint, manage your topsoil, segregate that, and then restore things back in a manner that gives you the best chance to have a successful restoration.
So the best management practices is essentially saying it's the best environmental management. Is that fair to say?
I think that's a fair statement, sure.
Switching gears, just a couple of things with the wildlife that are involved with this project. There doesn't appear to be much, but there are, well, I guess, really three species that are alluded to in the application. First one I want to talk about is the whooping crane. The application indicates that the project is located within the whooping crane's migratory corridor. What specific steps will One Oak take to ensure that the whooping crane is not adversely affected by this project?
Yes, sir. As I mentioned, we do a project kickoff with environmental training, and there is a section in there that we talk about the potential listed species, and with the potential of the whooping crane passing through in its migration, we would highlight that. There would be a photograph to help with identification purposes, and then the instruction to project personnel that in the event that a whooping crane or a possible whooping crane is sighted within 1/2 mile line of sight of active construction, that we would suspend heavy equipment operations and, similar to the unanticipated discovery, begin the notification process internally so that we can verify and then make the appropriate external communications. Those activities, the heavy equipment activities, would remain suspended until we had confirmation that the birds had vacated the area.
The other types of animals that were indicated in the application that at least stuck out to me were the bald and golden eagle. In the application, it indicated that field surveys were conducted on January 27th, 2015, confirming the absence of nests or nesting activities along the route. Does the time of year when these studies are done either enhance or lessen the chance of observing nests or habitats for the bald or golden eagle?
Yes, sir. Fish and Wildlife Guidelines recommends that if you do the type of survey that we did, which is pedestrian line of sight, that you do it prior to leaf out. And so any time leaves are off the tree, you can do a very adequate survey. There are other techniques you can go beyond that, particularly if you're a little bit late. But the timing is very closely associated primarily with leaf out.
So essentially what you're saying is a study done in the winter is more reliable than a study that would be done in the summer. Is that correct?
Correct.
What type of policy does One Oak have in place if there is an unexpected find of a bald or a golden eagle?
Right. It would be similar to the whooping crane in the fact that we would suspend activities. And most likely where it would really impact a project would be if a bird took up residency and wanted to nest. Their nest structures are very visible. The bald eagles primarily in trees. The golden eagles like more of a rugged terrain, more of a cliffside, so we don't have any of that habitat, so that's very unlikely. But in the event that prior to construction or at any time during construction we thought we encountered a previously unrecorded nest, we would bring out biologists with the proper credentials to go study that nest, one, determine if it's active, and then two, try to determine the species, and then follow guidelines published by the agencies as to what type of buffer would be appropriate to minimize impacts of that nesting behavior.
I have nothing further.
Ms. Prescott?
Yes, Your Honor. Bill? Just want to clarify as far as the widths of the field survey areas. So for the class three, it was 300 feet centered on the route. Is that correct?
Yeah. We did a little bit wider on our cultural in portions. So portions of the cultural resource survey did get out to 300 feet wide.
Okay. And then in the natural resources, it talks about an application 250 feet minimum. And then in the report, it says 200 feet wide survey corridor, 100 foot wide construction right away. Is that 250 feet centered on the route? Is that what that's
correct.
Indicating?
Yes, okay. Correct. Yes, ma'am.
So for the four wetlands that are within the, that were identified in the natural resources study within the survey area, then how many of those will actually be crossed by the route?
I think if you go to the amendment and go to Appendix B. And I would go to the second set of maps, the aerial background, and it would be map two. All the wetlands happen on map two. You'll see that our alignment actually crosses four wetland features that were surveyed. And so the answer is four.
Did I understand a previous witness to say that all four of those then would be bored?
Matt Turpin did indicate that they'd be bored. I might suggest that they would be crossed perhaps with an open cut or bored, depending on what the conditions are at the time, but certainly in conformance with Nationwide 12.
Thank you. Other questions, Your Honor?
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, Bill. Just one question from me, and that is, can you outline the pros and cons or the advantages or disadvantages of constructing the two lines kind of simultaneously, and what sort of particular reclamation advantages or challenges might be present with that type of construction?
Yes, ma'am. I think the first advantage is really the benefit of a common utility corridor. Rather than having two distinct projects and scars across the right of what, you know, across the landscape, we've consolidated to a common utility corridor. And I think that's always beneficial for a lot of different reasons. Secondarily, by co-locating them, one of the cons is that the first line going in, particularly at this time of year, perhaps that soil in area is not going to reach final stabilization, final restoration until the second line is completed and installed and restored. So there is a con that the first line is going to be in a stabilized state but not fully restored for an additional perhaps 2 months during the construction of the second line. On the flip side of that, one of the pros is that plan in place is to have a specific restoration contractor come through and do that full combined right-of-way restoration all at the same time continuously, and you're going to avoid impacting previously restored stuff with your second line being constructed. So the greatest con is that the first line is going to be in a stabilized but not restored state for a little bit extended time. The benefits are you have a common utility corridor and that the restoration process will be for the full right-of-way combined, and you won't be impacting and having to come back and trying to do repairs on one that's a little further along in restoration with your restoration efforts later.
Is there usually any sort of weed control or anything needed on the first line? That's, I'm assuming there's no cover on that, or do you mulch it, or what do you do in the 2 months that you're talking about where that's kind of exposed?
Sure, and there's several different ways to go about it. And generally, mulching is a very common technique to get some straw out and to mulch it and crimp it to hold it in place. The whole idea is to hold your soils in place until you can do the final grade and seeding. So but there are tackifiers that you can spray on that sometimes kind of put a crust on it and hold the surface. Occasionally, depending on what time of the year and how long it might be, you might actually put a cover crop in But with the timing that we're talking about late in the season, it's unlikely that a cover crop would germinate and really be beneficial. So most likely in this case, we would do a rough grade, come back in with a mulch of some type, anchor it, and hold it in place until the final restoration efforts would take place.
Will you get better grading as a whole on the total reclamation this way, doing it that way?
I think there's probably a benefit for that. A little bit hard to quantify, but if you're doing a contiguous 150, 200-foot corridor versus 100 feet and then coming back and doing the next 100 feet, I think you probably get a better graded product.
Okay. And is there a distance, a separation? I know there's some thoughts on appropriate distance just from an operational standpoint, but from a reclamation standpoint and construction standpoint, is there a best practice for distance apart for the two lines?
Right. I know every pipeline operator wants as much distance between their pipeline and activities as they can, safety, that sort of thing. And I know that there's a wide variety to it. So I guess to really answer you, the further apart they can be, the more comfortable the operators are.
But what about from a, I understand that from an operational standpoint, but what about from actual construction and mitigation and like just actual construction and reclamation process? Is it easier to have them closer or is it better to have a bigger separation?
From construction, I don't know if I'm the appropriate person, you know, for the equipment aspect, that sort of thing. But from reclamation, I don't know that the offset really makes a big difference.
Okay. You don't need space in between to operate and to pile soils and keep the subsoil from one side mixing with the topsoil on the other side and vice versa.
Right. And that's dictated or planned with our construction right-of-way and how they lay out the right-of-way. And when they have when they're working next to an existing line and they have an offset, they will adjust and modify accordingly. I think the preference is not to operate on a live line, so they might lose a little bit of workspace or they might offset it a little bit more so that they have the space to construct safely, but they will adjust accordingly.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. That's all my questions.
Commissioner Christman?
Just clarify for me, these wetlands, are these areas where there's typically water setting or running, or are these areas that occasionally could have water?
Yeah, I think these were temporary in the long sense. We're in a little bit of a wet cycle, so today they're probably wet. They're not flowages. The water is temporal and changes based on conditions.
Okay. And then regarding the residences, on the second aerial map, way to the north end, just on the west side of the project, that's the one that that One Oak has the waiver for, and that's the Thompsons, correct?
It is the Thompsons. It would be on page 2 of the aerial. And it would be the triangle right by milepost 2, if you can see milepost 2, that's green.
Okay, and then what's the orange triangle?
It would be another potential occupied structure, but that's greater than 500 feet from the center line of the pipeline.
Okay. Okay, and then on the first page, there's just the one that is obviously farther than 500 feet.
Correct.
Those are the only residences that fall within the whole study area.
That is correct.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you, Bill.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks to all my colleagues. It's great questions. I don't have any for this project, Bill. Well, I got you up here. How are we doing with that water pit up at that plant northeast of Williston you and I looked at a few years ago?
We've been, so if we're talking about the state line plants,
yep.
And we've continued to work with One Oak and the landowner and engineering firm. And we conducted the studies that were suggested by the Water Commission of pre-development and post-development discharges from that property. And that analysis found that we were in conformance with what the rule was, and that in fact we had reduced the discharge less than what it was pre-development. So that has been the extent of my involvement. It's still with One Oak and probably working with the landowners. I don't know if it's been fully resolved or not, but I did that analysis or coordinated that analysis and shared that back with One Oak.
Thank you. And the reason I ask it today is that the speaking for myself, you know, you get a level of trust or distrust with companies, and One Oak's been in front of us a lot, and there's always the commitment to do stuff that's right. And in that particular case, something came up from a landowner, talked to One Oak, went up and toured the site, and they continued to follow up on all those things to make sure landowners are happy. So, you know, the work that you did in that plant and the follow-through gives me a level of trust as we get into more of these other hearings. So thank you and the company for your work on that, and no further questions.
Mr. Morrison, any follow-up?
No follow-up.
Mr. Schmidt?
Just one. With regard to the agency responses, and this is just kind of a general question, but in a lot of times when you get these responses, there's a lot of recommendations. I know especially from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they'll send back, you know, a 12-page thing with a variety of recommendations. With regard to the recommendations from the agency, does One Oak commit itself to following those recommendations as outlined in responses to their inquiries to these agencies?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I have nothing further.
Ms. Prescott?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Chrisman? Commissioner Kolk? Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Anything further at this time? Okay. Are there any members of the public who would like to offer testimony at this time? Okay, doesn't appear so. Mr. Morrison, is there anything further, or do you have a closing statement you'd like to make?
We have no particular closing statement. As is customary, we would intend to file proposed findings, conclusions, and an order with the commission staff. We are asking that this be expedited as much as possible. The timing is that we want to meet that December 1st deadline, and if we can get on a meeting in August and get the order out in August, it'll just make sure that we don't have any winter construction issues to deal with. And since it appears to be a fairly clean proceeding, hopefully we can get that done in fairly short order.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Schmidt, anything further on behalf of advisory staff?
We have nothing further.
Okay. At this time, then, I'll take closing comments from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Well, I'll keep this short and sweet. Thank you very much for a good application, good hearing. There's no late filed exhibits. I think that's one of the first in my hearing experience, but there hasn't been at least one late filed exhibit. So I don't anticipate any big issues in working through this and getting an order out in August as you guys would prefer. So again, thanks to the company. Appreciate this is another piece of the important infrastructure to serve this important industry in North Dakota. And we like pipelines. They are the safest, most efficient, most effective way to transport these products. So this is another good piece of infrastructure to support the new gas plant and the ongoing efforts to reduce flaring. And so we will do our part of the deal now and get you turn around with an answer in short order.
Commissioner Christman?
Well, I'll just say since we're basically talking to company people here and one member of the press, and I believe at least one from McKenzie County government, but I've appreciated over the years working with One Oak and having Danette as the face of your company and John often as the attorney, and I just want to clarify for the company folks who, you know, haven't been here as often, the rationale for all of us trooping all the way out here to Watford City to have a hearing and nobody shows up. We, of course, have our policies and rules and law in place. And so when there's an application like this, this is what we do. We come out because it's important that the local people get an opportunity to testify. And in a case like this, nobody shows up, but at least they had the opportunity. In many other cases, we do have members of the public show up, and sometimes they're favorable toward the project, and sometimes they're unfavorable, but it is an important part, and even though in this case it may have seemed kind of uneventful, I do think it's a good and important policy that we keep coming out and having hearings out in the areas that are impacted by these kinds of projects. So we thank you all for those of you that came up from Tulsa or left your work for the day. Appreciate you being here.
Commissioner Kalk?
Just to begin, I guess, end where I started, just to thank One Oak for their commitment to get the flaring under control in North Dakota. Thank you for your work in North Dakota. It speaks volumes when you have previous cases in front of you and things come up and you work through them as we go into future cases. I know every case is based on a set of facts, but we're humans too. So if you have problems with the company in the past, it tends to come into your future hearings. And a very positive experience with One Oak. Appreciate the help on the call before you dig. As it came out again today, the biggest reason pipelines fail is third-party damage. So we're going to keep working on that for our friends from the county. Really appreciate more people coming out here being involved in this because the emergency response plan, well, we didn't talk a lot about it today. There's a lot in the application, and the counties really have the cards in these things. The counties are where they're closest to the battle. So I appreciate you coming by today. And also, if you have any follow-up questions with us, please let us know about this project and others, and encourage you to work with as well as One Oak. I know Danette came from there, but the Association of Counties is really a key organization for all of us to be involved with. So but anyway, travel safe as you go home. Thank you.
That concludes the public hearing in this matter. Thank you.